From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners like you, and we are very thankful for that. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show, and it is interesting indeed.
The company Hobby Lobby is now appealing a federal judge's decision requiring that they provide abortion pills in its health care coverage.
As the troubled rollout of the Affordable Care Act continues, a lot of the talk has focused on the healthcare.gov website and the confusion of a lot of folks regarding costs and changes in their insurance coverage. That's the big picture. But one specific aspect of the law that has held the attention of religious freedom advocates is the contraception mandate. Specifically this: can an employer who provides employee health coverage limit that coverage based on the employer's religious convictions? And can an entire business have religious convictions? The Supreme Court has just announced that it will be considering that question, and I'll be talking about where some of these convictions may come from with Jonathan Dudley, who has written about the fluid nature of some allegedly timeless and politically helpful religious beliefs.
The ACLU is suing the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, accusing them of promoting policies that undermine hospital care, especially when it comes to women.
Now here's the other side of the religious freedom and healthcare debate. What if a woman's personal reproductive choices are prioritized for her, not based on her health or even her very survival, but on the teachings of a church that the hospital is affiliated with? We've heard horror stories of this type out of Ireland and Chile, for example, where absolutist bans on abortion make no allowances for the life of the mother. But Michigan? The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a lawsuit that outlines a frightening incursion of religion into medical science, and the ACLU's Brooke Tucker, staff attorney at the ACLU of Michigan, will be here to brief us on that case. But first,
humanism is something that I think transcends just the lack of belief in whatever God somebody might want us to believe in. It's about good without God. It's what we do believe in, what we do stand for.
This weekend, something very exciting is happening at Harvard University. The well-respected and powerfully relevant humanist chaplaincy is moving into its new home and launching an unprecedented outreach effort that's destined to have an impact far from the ivy-covered walls of Cambridge. The opening of the hub marks a milestone in both the academic and societal potential of the humanist movement, and I'm very pleased that Harvard's humanist chaplain, Greg Epstein, is able to be back with us today here on State of Belief Radio. Greg, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Welton. It's always a pleasure.
Start, please, with a quick rundown of the history of the humanist chaplaincy at Harvard, how you cooperate with other chaplains, and whom you serve.
The humanist chaplaincy at Harvard, which now goes by the humanist community at Harvard, has been in existence for well over 30 years, over 35 years, actually. And it started as the first ever humanist chaplaincy serving atheists, agnostics, and the non-religious on a university campus in the United States. Mm-hmm. And that was started by my immediate predecessor, a former Catholic priest named Tom Ferrick. But Harvard University has never given any funding or financial support whatsoever. $0 and 0 cents total over those 35-plus years to the humanist community at Harvard, because Harvard, like many other universities, does not fund any of its chaplaincy or other similar communities around campus so as not to have to discriminate, sort of give more money to the Catholics and less to the Jews, or more to the humanists and less to the Zoroastrians, etc. they simply let us volunteer on their campus, and we can do a lot of things as long as we're financially independent. And so I took over this organization about 8.5 years ago, and it was a tiny little enclave for atheist, agnostic, and humanist students on our campus. We had a few active students, and we had an annual budget of $28,000 a year that included my annual salary and benefits, a $5,000 stipend for the previous chaplain because he was retiring and he hadn't saved for retirement, and any program we wanted to do. So it was a tiny little thing, and that's pretty much what people expected of humanist communities back then. But we have put together a variety of programs, thousands of programs that we've now run in this community since then, with tens and tens of thousands of people attending. And our the saying that we like to use for our programs is that they should be diverse, inclusive, and inspiring. And that means that they should involve a range of people that come from different cultural backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, language, gender, sexuality, age, etc. Inclusive in the sense that we're very open-minded to partnering with religious communities that have common ethical values or common goals, and being in dialogue with people who believe differently than we do. And inspiring in the sense that we stay focused on positive questions about how to live a good and meaningful life as a human being and how to make this world better for all people, not just for ourselves and certainly not just for people who believe like we do. And we've kept that in mind across thousands and thousands of programs. And what we've finally set out to do, and now we're in the process of achieving, is we felt like we needed a physical space, a destination, a home to symbolically represent our community, but more than symbolically, to allow us to do the ambitious kinds of programs that we were trying to do to make people's lives in our community better. And so we're finally opening that place after years of work and raising hundreds of thousands of dollars from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of donors. We're opening a 3,200-square-foot facility in the heart of Harvard Square, and we're calling it the Humanist Hub.
What are some of the services that you'll be adding through the hub?
There are a really diverse range of programs that are meant for people of every age. This is a university-affiliated community, but it's really meant for, anyone and everyone who is interested in this type of community that lives in our local area, and, B, there are actually several programs that we're going to be running that are relevant to people who live anywhere and everywhere. And so I'll start with the youngest. We have started a Sunday school equivalent or alternative program that we call the Learning Lab. And it's actually run in part by Harvard students, actually in large part by Harvard students. Graduate students at the Divinity School and at the and PhD students at the Graduate School of Education who are researching education, researching how to educate people about moral and ethical values, et cetera, are designing a curriculum that we're putting in place right now once a month for kids ages from real young ages like 3, 4, 5 to up to about 7, 8, 9 or so, and we're eventually going to expand it from preschool all the way through a kind of a confirmation class. But it's to teach kids how to be moral and ethical citizens of the world while also identifying with a community of humanists when they might otherwise simply in their families say, oh, we're nothing, or we're simply a combination of these different backgrounds, but we don't actually believe anything. We're teaching kids how to be able to say, well, my family, we may have some religious backgrounds, and we, one of my parents may be religious, but, another parent or both parents may be humanists. And talking about their positive values, and even young kids can learn a lot about that prepares them to be a good citizen of the world. And so we're doing that program, and we're using art and music and science and all sorts of things to educate kids about ethics. And
oh, that is just terrific.
We do regular interfaith community service programs. So that means that we as humanists and atheists set out to once a month lead a community service endeavor that we invite our religious neighbors to participate with. The most recent project was a really nice success. We packaged 50,000 meals for hungry kids in our area, nutritious, non-perishable meals On Sunday, November 24th, right before Thanksgiving, we had hundreds of people come out for about a six-hour series of shifts to package these meals. We raised $12,000 to pay for the supplies for the meals. It was really a very nice event. So we do those kinds of things regularly. And then every Sunday, people are going to be able to come to the Humanist Hub and hear inspiring talks. We've got a Humanist Hub house band with some extremely accomplished musicians playing a really interesting mix of music. We've got discussion groups of many different kinds, ranging from addiction recovery to exploring existential questions in life to parenting support group, et cetera, et cetera, all around the ideals of humanism.
How is that being seen by, for example, longtime members of what was called the University Church in the Harvard Yard?
The Memorial Church, you mean?
Right. But a lot of people said University Church. Yeah, I was talking Memorial Church.
So the Memorial Church has been very supportive. Many of your listeners may know that we had a longtime famous minister named Peter Gomes here who died a few years ago now. And the new young minister here at Memorial Church is named Jonathan Walton. And I just want to say, if he's listening, shout out to him. He's been incredibly supportive, incredibly gracious about supporting the idea of a humanist community at Harvard alongside all the other religious communities that he's tasked with supporting. So I'm very grateful. I spoke alongside Jonathan at Harvard's memorial service after the marathon bombings in April, and I felt on behalf of our community that we were so warmly welcomed at Harvard, and he and President Faust and others were terrific. Now, on the one hand, we wish that Harvard would change its policy and just send us a check so that it would make this sort of work easier, but on the other hand, you know, it is better for us to be independent. We are an independent nonprofit, which means that we're able to really set our own program agenda alongside our affiliation with Harvard and serving Harvard students. And that has actually allowed us in the past year to take on this new project called the Humanist Community Project, which is, since we've had such wonderful and interesting and challenging experiences pioneering what it means to set up a full-scale humanist community in this area, we've decided in the last 2-3 years that we really need to take that experience and put it to good use for humanists nationwide. And so what we're doing is we're actively studying right now not only our own experiences, but the experiences of those who are building what we playfully call godless congregations all across the United States. And we're trying to work right now on building a network of many different types of humanist communities or godless congregations all across the U.S. so that we can learn from and with one another and over the next few years build a solid, sustainable, growing, dynamic network of humanist communities and godless congregations across the United States.
That's great. I want to switch gears. Last year, just about this time, I had a fascinating conversation with a brilliant rabbi about getting through Christmas from a Jewish perspective. You face that with not only Christmas, but with Hanukkah in the Jewish tradition. I'd like to ask you the same question, and I'm not talking about the commercial overkill of the season, but the general tone that's impossible to avoid in this country. How do you navigate this time of the year and not feel like an outsider?
You know, I myself, I'm working on this all the time, and we're organizing some very meaningful holiday season celebrations in our community, especially around this phenomenon of building a new center. So those that I'm directly surrounded by, I think a lot of us are feeling actually more confident these days. We've got a physical space. We've got a way to celebrate our own sense of what this time of year means to us. But I know that, you know, many out there still do not, and there are many in other parts of the country who really do still feel very put upon in some unfortunate ways by a more narrow-minded sense of what this time of year is supposed to mean, Bill O'Reilly, among others, right? And so, you know, I guess I'm just grateful that you're representing a Christian perspective that is more open-minded and broad-minded and supportive of my community. I think that that's all we can really ask, because we've got some really creative people in our community nationwide, and you know, what we're doing is we're saying, actually, this time of year, it gets darker. It gets colder.
Right.
We need to come together. And that is true for people across many traditions. And that's really why a lot of the Christmas traditions evolved the way that they did. You know, the reason why we light lights and give gifts and come together, especially at this time of year, is because psychologically we need it in the Northern Hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
And humanists are no different from that. And so we've got a lot of different rituals, whatever we call them. Some like the idea of just celebrating a secular version of Christmas or Hanukkah. Some, you know, just wait for New Year's or celebrate the solstice or make up new holidays like human light. But, you know, however you want to do it, I mean, these days, Welton, this godless congregation phenomenon mm-hmm. is just exploding. There's so many different secular and humanist community groups, and I think every one of them must have its own way of doing things, and that's brilliant. We just want to study the ones that are getting the biggest response and help to spread those responses all around the country so we don't have to have this conversation anymore, because if you're doing Christmas, you should have fun with it. You shouldn't need to apologize to us, and we shouldn't need to apologize to you. We should all just embrace the fact that we've got a diverse country and we've got many ways of celebrating.
You and I have the kind of relationship that you could come to me and say, how do you deal with the mean fundamentalists in mm-hmm. Christianity?
Mm-hmm.
And I would feel responsible for saying I probably feel like you do about them. Mm-hmm. But you know, and I know that there are some people, I don't think nearly so many in the humanist community, but maybe as in the atheist community itself,
mm-hmm.
who are living with anger mm-hmm. and resentment because I think they still feel like outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
How do you relate to people in the humanist or the atheist community that feel so angry about it all? And I'm asking it because I wonder if it's similar to what I feel about Christians that are angry at everybody else.
And how do you deal with angry Christians?
I deal with them by saying, that's not the gospel I know. That's mm-hmm. not the religion that I celebrate.
Yeah. We here in the humanist community that I'm a part of, and this godless congregation movement that is emerging across the country and around the world right now, there really is a consensus emerging, and I'm not dictating this. I'm merely reporting it and, mm-hmm. and to some extent agreeing with it. There's a consensus emerging that what we're trying to do by building secular congregations, godless congregations, is we are trying to represent a positive set of ideals, a positive response to life. We're recognizing that life isn't easy. We are the only ones who can and therefore are responsible to make the world better,
mm-hmm.
and that the way to make the world better is by connecting with one another.
Yeah.
And that's our job, and that's our primary focus, and we're trying not to get distracted. I'm trying, mm-hmm. at least, not to get distracted by excessive negative energy. Now, sometimes the world presents us with abuses. Sometimes mm-hmm. religion, as one among many human institutions, you know, really is responsible for abusing mm-hmm. some people.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are rightfully angry, and there is a lot to be angry about. But as you say, it's not all religion. So, you know, if you're going to express anger, you know, express anger about what's happened to you and who did it to you. But it's not that every religious person is the same or every religious tradition is the same.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that we can express anger as one of our human emotions, but we can also do something very positive. And I think that, you know, any Christian, any humanist, any religious person of any denomination or sect has the ability to care and have compassion for others. I mean, any healthy person at the very least.
Yeah.
I just think that our communities are really working to do the positive work, and that, I think, will in itself help change the dialogue very much.
Well, that's a fantastic answer. Greg Epstein is the humanist chaplain at Harvard University. He's got a big weekend. It's the grand opening of The Hub, an ambitious project of service and outreach that promises to elevate both the visibility and the substance of the humanist movement in the years ahead. Greg, congratulations on the progress that you've made there. And it's always great to talk with you on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Welton. Appreciate everything that you're doing.
Later in the show, Jonathan Dudley on the Supreme Court's consideration of two religious freedom cases. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. As useful as the American Civil Liberties Union is as a rhetorical punching bag for many conservatives, for almost a century, the organization's work has been absolutely invaluable in challenging some of the most blatant and dangerous attacks on the freedoms to which each of us is entitled. Often taking deeply unpopular but always principled stands, the ACLU also serves to highlight representative cases that ought to make each of us think deeply about what it means to have our rights defined by laws based on the Constitution and not on locally determined majority whims. This week, you may have heard of the case of a pregnant woman in Michigan whose medical care and access to information were determined not by science, but by the religious affiliation of the hospital in which this woman found herself. The only hospital, I might add, in the area. Well, the ACLU has taken on the case of Tamisha Means, and here to talk about that is Brooke Tucker, who is staff attorney at the ACLU of Michigan. Brooke, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Would you just begin by describing the Michigan case for the listeners?
What happened here is that Tamisha Means, our client, when she was 18 weeks pregnant, her water broke. She had three children, and she knew to get to the hospital right away when this happened. So she called a friend for a ride and immediately went to the only hospital in her county, Mercy Health Partners. When she went, the hospital diagnosed her with preterm premature rupture of membrane. Normally, when a person's diagnosed with that condition, they are told about their available options and that induction of labor immediately is the safest course of treatment. However, that did not happen in this case. The hospital told her there was nothing it could do and sent her home. She came back the next day in immense pain and bleeding, asking for help. And again, the hospital said there was nothing it could do and sent her home. She came back later that evening with a fever, signs of infection, again begging for help. The hospital staff again told her there was nothing they could do and prepared to send her home. At that time, she began to deliver. And only then did the hospital finally start tending to her miscarriage.
Mm. It is a heart-wrenching story, but I know that the ACLU doesn't do just heart-wrenching stories and take them as cases. What made the ACLU say they would take this case?
Well, one, we've noticed that this is happening all across the country because of the ethical and religious directives for Catholic health care services. And these are mandatory hospital policies promulgated by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops that dictate what can and cannot be provided at Catholic healthcare facilities, regardless of what a patient's physician deems medically best. And in this situation, a public health educator informed us that there were at least five instances of this happening at this particular hospital, and we didn't want there to be one more instance of this happening where, you know, fortunately, Ms. Means survived. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in these cases, sometimes the condition is life-threatening, and we didn't want it to get to a point where someone actually died.
Why did the hospital not want to do that right up front? Because of they knew what would happen to the fetus? Or what's the answer to that question? What did they want from her?
The directives, in particular, there's one directive that says pregnancy termination or abortion is never permitted so long as the fetus has a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, the fetus still had a heartbeat, although it was not viable and there was virtually no chance that the fetus would survive given mm-hmm. that her water broke at 18 weeks. Nonetheless, the directives state that you're not allowed to terminate the pregnancy. So the hospital's hands were tied in this case. And not only did they fail to provide her with this care, they also could not inform her that she needed this care.
So they really, under the directive, had no responsibility to take care of the woman, just a directive related to the fetus.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Explain, please, why the lawsuit doesn't name the hospital but names the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops as the defendants.
You know, what happened in this case is not an isolated instance of something happening at one hospital to one patient. This is something that's happening all across the country, and it's a direct result of the policies issued by these non-medical professionals, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Mm-hmm.
And so because it is their policy that caused this unnecessary trauma to happen to Ms. Means, that is why they are the defendant in this case.
Brooke, you've mentioned there were several cases that you all had heard of like this, but how widespread is the problem of religiously driven limits to treatment and even to information in our healthcare system?
This is a nationwide problem. We know of situations in Phoenix, Colorado, Michigan, all over where this is happening, and doctors feel as though their hands are tied and they are not able to provide the best care to their patients because of these ethical and religious directives.
Is any of this due to a shrinking number of hospitals? Does that make this problem worse?
This makes the problem exponentially worse. Ms. Meads went to this hospital in part because it's the only hospital in the county. Just a few years ago, there were two hospital options. One was secular and one was Catholic operated. Had there still been two options, it's possible she would have had another choice and she would never have had to go through this experience. But now, because those hospitals merged and are now under a singular Catholic operated healthcare system, there was only one option available. And that option was one where doctors were not able to provide her with all of the information and treatment options that she probably would have received at a secular facility.
Mm-hmm. Brooke, I know the ACLU is staffed by extremely smart people with a lot of experience. So you're bound to have looked at legal precedents on this case. And I wonder what legal precedents you have found that give you hope in taking on this case.
Well, as you may know, we sued under a state law negligence theory. And what negligence says, regardless of whether it's a case involving medical care or other types of injuries, is that a person is liable for the foreseeable consequences of their actions. And in this case, you have ethical and religious directives that explicitly state they must be followed by all Catholic healthcare services.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, when you have non-medical professionals dictating policies for all institutions saying that they must be followed, it is foreseeable that hospitals will in fact follow them. And when they do, you are liable for any harm that results from that practice.
Hmm. So in making the decision, you also saw that it made more sense, was more reasonable to sue the Catholic bishops than to sue the hospital that was being obedient to the Catholic bishops.
Exactly. You know, it's a decision. Do you sue the person that makes the policy or the person that implements the policy? And in this case, when you have something that affects so many people on a nationwide scale, it makes sense to go after the root of the problem, which is these directives that force religious beliefs onto medical professionals and end up resulting in patients not being provided with necessary information and care.
Yeah. Is there precedent in anticipating the outcome? Does this get into that realm of faith versus science? How is that going to be a part of what you have to deal with?
I don't think so.
Okay.
As you know, the ACLU has long been a defender of religious freedom and religious liberty,
right.
And we fully support the right of the bishops and anyone else to express their religious beliefs on health care and other issues. We are not going after that in this mm-hmm. case. The problem is when your religious beliefs prevent medical professionals from providing necessary care. That's all that's at issue in this case. Medical yeah. professionals and patients should be determining the type of care the patient receives, not the Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Brooke, what would be a successful outcome?
In our mind, vindication for Ms. Means, as well as a declaration that these directives are negligent, and with the hope that they will no longer be forced upon medical professionals around the country. That would be the best outcome in this case. If we could go back to medical professionals doing what they believe is in the patient's best interest, hospitals would think long and hard before they started imposing these policies on the treating providers, because they would now be subject to a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
And it is my sincere hope that the bishops will think long and hard as well about whether they want to continue to prevent patients around this country from getting the care that they receive.
Brooke is with the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan. The organization is suing the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops over a Michigan woman's medical care in a Catholic hospital, contending that decisions were based not on her condition, but the ideology of the church as expressed through the Catholic bishops. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. I look forward to hearing from you again.
Dr. Jonathan Dudley is the author of the book Broken Words: The Abuse of Science and Faith in American Politics. Thanks to his invaluable analysis of the way evangelical Christianity has radically changed its stand on issues like abortion, and done so in our lifetimes, he's the person I wanted to talk to about some of the timeless values at the heart of two cases the Supreme Court has agreed to hear. Jonathan, it's great to have you back with us on State of Belief Radio.
It's great to be back.
Would you briefly refresh the memories of our listeners about the changes in the seminal teachings on abortion that you describe in your book?
I grew up in the evangelical community, and growing up, I had always believed that, you know, the Bible clearly says that life begins at conception, and this is the Christian position, and it's what Christians have always believed. When I went to school at Yale Divinity School and started actually really studying this history, I was very surprised to learn that, in fact, this is a very recent belief mm-hmm. in both the Catholic and the evangelical traditions. For most of Christian history, the Catholic tradition has held that life begins at formation, which is when the developing fetal body begins to have brain activity and to have organs formed. And it was thought that life only begins at that point because that's when the soul can be infused. And the change to conception in the Catholic tradition actually occurred in the mid-1800s for a variety of complex reasons I talk about in my book.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps most interesting for our purposes is how evangelical thinking has evolved on abortion. One thing that most people don't know is that in the late 1960s and early 1970s, most evangelical leaders actually supported looser abortion laws. And they did so in large part because there was a widespread belief among evangelical theologians and scholars that the Bible teaches that life begins at birth.
Mm-hmm.
And this is based on a verse in Exodus where it was interpreted, at the time at least, as suggesting that if a man hits a pregnant woman and she miscarries, then the penalty is a fine. But if the pregnant woman dies, then it's life for life.
Hmm.
Evangelical scholars took this as suggesting a difference in the moral value of fetal life versus maternal life.
Mm-hmm.
And in the late 1960s, the magazine Christianity Today, the main evangelical magazine, hosted a symposium of evangelical leaders from around the country and also published a special issue on contraception and abortion, in which the leading article in that issue, authored by Bruce Watke from Dallas Theological Seminary, argued that the Bible plainly teaches that life begins at birth based on this Exodus 21 passage.
You may recall, I come out of that same tradition. Were you staggered at that, or did you remember some of that as I do?
I did not know any of that because I'm still a fairly young guy, so I wasn't born at the time. I was born in the mid-1980s when the evangelical right had kind of taken over and the shift in thinking had already occurred. So, while I was growing up, I had assumed it was always that way.
I see.
So I was shocked when I was doing this research.
I remember sitting in Southern Baptist Convention's annual sessions, and there was a very progressive resolution every year on abortion. So what you're pointing out, a lot of older people ought to remember, but it is important to remember it now.
I think there are a few reasons that this is so interesting and significant. I mean, on the one hand, you could say, well, evangelicals have changed their thinking on abortion. That doesn't necessarily mean their thinking is wrong, and that's true.
Right, right.
Over the course of the 1970s, there was this massive shift from believing the Bible clearly teaches that life begins at birth and generally supporting looser abortion laws to around 1980, thinking the Bible clearly teaches that life begins at conception. In fact, Jerry Falwell started teaching on abortion and speaking out against it and writing on it in the late 1970s. And in his main book, where he first really discusses abortion in a chapter called The Right to Life, he argues that the Bible clearly teaches that life begins at conception based on Psalm 139. And so the reason that I think evangelicals began interpreting the Bible that way is because Catholics had held the position previously that life begins at conception for reasons that weren't biblical but were based on analytic philosophy and science. And so because evangelicals kind of, around the late 1960s, while evangelicals still had these more liberal views on abortion, Catholics had already developed more conservative views from the change in doctrine that occurred in Catholicism in the mid-1800s. So that immediately after Roe v. Wade, while evangelicals still weren't that concerned, Catholics formed the National Right to Life Committee. They started a lot of activism. In the mid-1970s, evangelicals began being more politically active on topics like combating feminism, combating homosexuality. And they eventually begin to see abortion as one of the elements of the sexual revolution that concerned them. And Catholics had kind of established the vocabulary and the beliefs that characterized the anti-abortion position. So as evangelicals started cooperating with them, they started kind of reinterpreting the Bible as teaching what Catholics had already established as the anti-abortion position.
I see. I want to get to the application of this to what we see happening right now. The Supreme Court, as you know, has agreed to hear arguments in two cases that involve private businesses claiming religious exemptions to the Affordable Care Act's reproductive health mandate. While the Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Specialties cases differ, they share the principle of a company being able to have a religious conscience. Now, how much more complicated do things get when some of the convictions are relatively arbitrary based on the recent history and the changes in it?
Yeah, well, that kind of gets back to the significance of the historical shift.
Right.
Just because people change their minds doesn't mean they're wrong. I think what's problematic is when evangelicals and other Christians come out saying that this is so clearly what the Bible teaches that a reasonable person can't disagree. Because I think that's hard to maintain when those very same leaders held the complete opposite position several decades ago.
Yeah.
Clearly the Bible is not clear enough on abortion that there's only one reasonable interpretation. If nearly all current religious right leaders didn't think the Bible teaches that.
Yeah.
Around, say, even as late as 1970. So it kind of undermines the claim that the Bible has a clear position on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
It also undermines the claim that the religious right's position on this issue flows from just historic Christian doctrine, or that they're just defending traditional Christian beliefs. While Christians have always been morally opposed to abortion, the idea that it's murder from conception onward, which is really the idea that justifies making it illegal, is actually pretty recent.
Mm-hmm.
You can be morally opposed to abortion, as Christians historically have been, without believing it's murder from conception, and therefore you can support it being legal, even if you think it's morally wrong.
Right.
So the significance of this shift is that by making abortion murder, it provides a very strong legal basis to make it illegal.
Well, Jonathan, you're also a medical doctor. As you've listened to these issues being debated, is there glaring medical misinformation that you're hearing that muddies the waters even further?
I think there's a lot of medical misinformation. I think you see a lot of the same tendencies that you see in the religious right on issues like intelligent design or evolution or global warming. There's a tendency to kind of, instead of asking, like, what's the truth about the situation, there's mm-hmm. a tendency to kind of say, okay, our position is this. Mm-hmm. Now let's go rummage around in medical journals to find quotes that support this position. And one good example of this recently is with the fetal pain legislation. There's been a push to outlaw abortions starting at 20 weeks because many proponents on the religious right claim that this is when fetuses can first start to feel pain,
mm-hmm.
where in fact there is roughly a medical consensus that places it much later. And a lot of the arguments made for saying that fetal pain begins at 20 weeks are based on, you know, taking things out of context or kind of just finding quotes that seem to support your position, but mm-hmm. even if the authors actually don't. So yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of pseudoscience of the sort that you see elsewhere propagated by the religious right.
You make a really compelling case in your book that political considerations have contributed significantly to the change in doctrine among some conservative Christian denominations. Do you see a political component to the current birth control debates going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can understand a lot of the reaction against the idea that employers should provide health care as stemming, in addition to just Christian moral beliefs about contraception and abortion. I think a lot of it also stems from hostility towards big government
mm-hmm.
that isn't necessarily a feature unique to the Christian tradition, but that has come for a variety of, you know, historical factors to characterize a lot of conservative Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, with the government, you know, they see it as kind of intervening in our reproductive choices by requiring this. I think that a lot of that stems more from idiosyncratic political beliefs that aren't Christian but happen to characterize a lot of Christians and be held by a lot of Christians.
Yeah.
Not so much by uniquely Christian beliefs. So.
I have the feeling that the justices on the Supreme Court would do well to read your book. Because
I'd recommend that as well.
<They're>,
very generous.
Well, because there is also this mischaracterization that you've really challenged about what the history is, and they may be dealing with what they think's history, and it's not history at all. When the dust settles, who do you think will be the winners and losers in this matter?
It is somewhat hard to predict where the court will go, but given that five of the justices tend to have more conservative views on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's likely that there will be a ruling in favor of religious conservatives
yeah.
on this topic. And I'm not entirely sure what will happen after that. I mean, it seems to me, at least, you know, just from my perspective, very unfair that someone who is not a Catholic but working for a major Catholic organization should not be able to have contraception covered in their health plan
yeah.
simply because of the employer's personal beliefs.
Right.
I mean, on the one hand, you can think, well, you know, just getting condoms isn't that expensive. But on the other hand, some of the more effective approaches, like condoms are cheap, but they're not that effective. Some of the mm-hmm. more effective ones are intrauterine devices
mm-hmm.
that have a less than 1% failure rate, whereas condoms have about 20%. Those are very expensive. They can be up to $1,000. And it can be hard for a lot of the people who really need birth control the most, poorer people who are don't have the resources to support a family to have access to those if they're not covered. So I think it could disproportionately harm poor people and result in more unwanted pregnancies and, ironically, more abortions.
I actually think that is a conservative point of view, but it's a conservative point of view held by a lot of progressive thinkers as well, because we're dealing there with reality and not ideology. Jonathan Dudley is the author of the book Broken Words, The Abuse of Science and Faith in American Politics. He's a graduate of Yale Divinity School who's also a medical doctor. And so he brings a unique and valuable perspective to the way health, religion, and ethics are impacting each other in today's political environment. Jonathan, it's always great to talk with you. I thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
It's great to be here anytime.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. One of the things I love about State of Belief Radio is that we take topics that you hear talked about in a lot of other places, but not like this. And you get into some details here that you don't get into at other places. I'm grateful for the people that were on the show today and how much they helped us understand some of these matters that are in the public eye. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show. Hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. We would love that. Stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. We encourage you to tell others about this show. The things we've talked about today are topics that need to be talked about by every person in this nation. It's a time to share values, perspectives, encourage others to listen so they can be a part of the conversation. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, that's State of Belief.